Welcome to the Golf Betting System Podcast 59. We're covering the 2019 Genesis Open on the PGA Tour and the ISPS Handa World Super 6 on the European Tour. This podcast is for listeners of 18 and above. I'm Steve Bamford, PGA Tour previewer at Golf Betting System, and with me we have European Tour expert Paul Williams. Evening to you, Paul.
Evening, Steve. Congratulations on your little coup with Mr. Mickelson just now.
I'll tell you a little story about that in a minute.
Just witnessed him ease himself over the line at Pebble Beach, which was.
Did you witness
nice
it? I didn't even see it.
Right, no, I say witness it. I was sitting watching the leaderboard on the computer, but yes, he didn't appear to be in any trouble over those last couple of holes that he was finishing off. Yeah, absolutely. Loves a bit of pebble, doesn't he?
GolfBettingSystem.co.uk. We're available on social media. You can join our Golf Betting System Facebook group. We're now through the 4,500 member level, I suppose you'd call it. The link is available in the description box. Right, I'm at Bamford Golf on Twitter and Paul is at Golf Betting. Look out for the Golf Betting System YouTube channel where I present the Golf Betting Show every week. In fact, I've just produced one for Paul's tournament. The podcast is available on Podbean, iTunes, Spotify, and a myriad of different pod channels. You can also listen, and many, many do, via our Golf Betting System YouTube channel. Naturally, subscribe and follow the podcast, and please take time to rate and review us on iTunes. And naturally, as we do every week, that's if anyone leaves one, I will read them out at the start of next week's show. We know Genesis Open Paul is going to be a very well listened to podcast. Tiger Woods is playing. I have to say, it is at the top end a rather major-like looking entry list this week. We'll go into that in a bit more detail in a short while. Anyway, back to this story.
Got it.
Let's classify it as a kind of recap of last week, John. As you're very aware, Paul, some listeners might be. I was in Amsterdam at the weekend on the worst stag do I've ever been on. Now, that's not to say I didn't enjoy the stag do, because I did, but there was no organisation whatsoever. So, like 20 lads are out there, and I saw most of the others for about 5 minutes. Mm. But anyway, that's by the by. But anyway, cut a long story short, get home yesterday afternoon, not feeling the best of spirits, tired, hungover, la la la. So I retired last evening about 9 o'clock UK time, and there was no way I was watching any golf whatsoever. And actually, watching it this morning on the recap, I don't think they started playing till God knows. There was like a two hour delay again, wasn't
there? There was a delay at the start, and then they played for a bit, and then the hail came down, and that pushed it all back as well. So yeah, it was never going to quite get done, I don't think.
So wake up this morning, have a bit of a lie until 7 in the morning, which, as you know, Paul, for a Monday is very late for us. Right? Look at my phone. Oh, I tell them, Phil Mickelson's won, I say to the missus. That's great. I've got a winner. Fantastic. And then it was only 45 minutes later when you popped my my actual balloon and said, Steve, it hasn't finished yet. Oh, and by the way, you can't do any of the work that you usually do on a Monday because none of the statistics will have updated. So that's that.
Yeah, and your odds for the Riviera are not going to be up until late, if at all, on Monday from some of the bookies. It just sets it all back.
That's very true.
It does scupper things when these Monday finishes come along.
I think we did learn a few things last week, as we always do. Phil on a soft golf course is just mercurial. We've always known that. When he can control those inbound... I mean, he was in the top 8 for GIR around Pebble Beach.
Yeah.
I think Phil is the most natural Poana putter, level with Jason Day and Brant Snedeker. Yeah. I think those three are on a pedestal, aren't they?
Sorry.
I did forget the rather obvious one of Dustin Johnson as well. Those four are on a pedestal when it comes to Poana.
Yeah, he gets on with the surface. He clearly gets on with Pebble, doesn't he? Was that his fifth win at Pebble overall now? It's a big old event and big venue for him and his career.
Did you catch any of the coverage? Because I know it's a difficult one to watch.
Yeah, little bits and pieces.
They were saying that the rough is pretty much where they're going to have it for the US Open.
On Pebble Beach itself, yeah. We shall see. So
it was interesting on the Sky Sports coverage, because one of the experts said that he thought Phil would have a fantastic shot at the US Open.
Mm.
And then that was completely sort of, oh, I don't agree with that. from the other guy on there. So, don't know. What are your thoughts? Do you think it'd have to be a very soft course for Mickelson to survive a US Open?
The conditions are going to be very different, aren't they? That's, you know, those players who came along this week and were hoping to get some kind of feeling as to what the US Open is going to be like in a few months' time. It's going to be like June, so you're talking more or less 4 months from now, aren't you? Just over 4 months. It's going to be very, very different, isn't it? Does that mean that Lefty can't win it? He's clearly stepped up a little mark again in his game, hasn't he, over the last, what, year or so, from the WGC that he won last year. Clearly he's got over the line again at one of his favourite venues just now. He's going to be very popular for the Masters again, isn't he? You know, Punton's going to put, you know, two and two together, and, you know, who's playing well, Lefty, who loves Augusta, Lefty. His price is going to be slaughtered, particularly if he shows any more form between now and then. But yeah, going back to your question, does that mean that he's not going to perform well in June? I don't think so. I think, you know, he's still got a bit about him, hasn't he?
Conditions dependent, I think, very much so.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's a quality act, and we kind of said it last week. It was going to be nasty weather, cold weather.
Yep.
So selecting four players that. Three of them were starting on Monterey. That worked quite nicely because you knew that you were going to get a good number of those Monterey elite players at the top of the leaderboard because they were on the easiest course in the easiest soft conditions on the Thursday. It all came together quite nicely.
Yep.
And then it's like from there, you just know with Phil, once he's got a sniff on a course, you know, clearly one of the most favourite courses he plays, he's going to hang around. I thought Paul Casey played quite well for three rounds, clearly, but he's just in when he's leading, it's just not a good story, is it, with Paul Casey?
No, you know, and he got over the line last year, didn't he, with that, you know, outstanding putting round that he produced. But
he wasn't leading. That was one where he'd actually come from behind, wasn't it?
Yeah. It's, you know,
Copperhead.
That's that kind of performance from him on a Sunday is the exception. It's not the rule by any stretch, is it? And yeah, and not just that performance, but a putting day like that isn't what you expect with Paul Casey. He just kind of tightens up, doesn't he? He doesn't necessarily freeze. He doesn't necessarily, you know, collapse. It just all gets a bit tighter, and you know, you're not making the birdies that you need to produce the round to get yourself over the line. You know, that's. That win aside, every other time you look at it recently, and you know, he'd be a lay on a Sunday from whatever position he's in. It's, but yeah, you know, his downfall was your to your benefit this week, so all good.
Yeah, that happened at the Travellers last year as well, if you remember. We were on Bubba, weren't we?
Yeah.
And Bubba came from about five behind, and Paul was shooting one over, two over on the Sunday again.
Yep.
It is a common story with Paul Casey, especially a player that's often quite overpriced, in my opinion. Because, you know, when you've got a conversion record that he's got and you're getting like 28 to 1 or 22 to 1, it's difficult, isn't it?
Yep.
Now, the other couple of players I know took real note of this week, one was Siwoo Kim. And as we're very aware, Siwoo is an absolute Bermuda monster.
Yep.
And week after next, we touch down in Florida for the Florida Swing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's definitely one to take a mental note for, I think.
Yeah, we were talking about Matt Every off air as well in terms
yeah,
of
Matt Every,
showing some improvement. And when he hits, he's going to be relatively limited on his starts, isn't he, because of his status. But when that hits Florida and you see him in the field, again, not necessarily for a win, but I know you've picked him up at a mad price for first-round leader in the past. And
yes.
He started, was it event before last, wasn't it? He started with something like six straight birdies, or he was six under through six or something like that. That's the kind of player he is. He can produce these mad low rounds, and
we've also got a couple of these alternate events coming up, haven't we?
Yeah.
So Corrales and Puerto Rico, they're the kind of events where he just pop up.
Yeah.
Coastal, soft golf course, Paspalum greens. Yeah. I think he's definitely got a first round leader call in him over the next few times you see him.
Yeah, and it's generally a mad price outright, which does tend to translate to, you know, a pretty juicy price for first round leader as well. So one to keep an eye on, I think.
Obvious one for this week as well is Scott Stallings, who played. He always pops up on Poana, loves the West Coast. As we discussed last week, the link between Torrey Pines and Pebble. And there you go. He shoots a cracking round on the Sunday. He's as big as 80, even 90 to 1 with Bet365. And that's already been nibbled. Mm. He's also the Salt Stallings who, when he finds the all-round game, because he's actually more of a ball striker, but when the putter warms on a surface that he likes, he's more than capable of stringing one, two, even three good tournaments together and then disappearing forever.
Yeah, he strikes me as one of those underrated kind of players who, again, he tends to be a far longer price than you might expect. And he can
good
win.
On a classical course as well. Good on a classical course, which suggests that they've got a, you know, they're not just ripping apart a resort course. They can actually move the ball both ways and scramble, manage themselves around.
Yep.
Yeah, so Stallings is a shout, I think.
Yeah, these players who produce a lot of miscuts and often get kind of discarded, but when they do hit a track or a part of the country or whatever the, you know, or a putting surface or whatever it is that that they feel more comfortable on, you can tend to pick up some decent prices, and they've got a far better chance than people think, I think.
What did you get out of the Vic Open last week?
Yeah, well,
apart from a sore head.
Yeah, disappointment really, because as we saw on Thursday with Nick Flanagan, who got off to an absolute fly, didn't he? 62 in the first round, 10 under.
What price were you on him at?
250s. So yeah, he started wide. He started well. He was two shots clear. He was still in the tie for the lead going into the weekend, and he got caught in the final group. He was out there with Jason Scrivener, who equally had a bad round on Saturday, and as the
who was 12 to 1, 12 to 1 Scrivener and 250 to 1 shot Flanagan.
Yeah, and they were both out late and naturally, and it was a tough old day, particularly for the later starters. It got really windy, and that track there, clearly when the wind blows, it is a challenging course. When it's benign, as with a lot of these coastal tracks, there's not much to protect it, but as the wind was blowing, and Scrivener and Flanagan both shot 76, that was the round that Scrivener picked up his tee marker when he went to move it for one of his playing partners to putt, and incurred himself a penalty there. Bit of a brain fart, but these things happen, don't they? But yeah, so Flanagan went backwards. He did, to be fair, he shot a decent round, 69 in the final round, 3 birdies to finish, and he came 10th, but that's no good when you're backing him each way. I did actually get 3 of them through to the final round, so Jeff Ress and Paul Dunn both got through to the final round. And when you've only got 35 players in the final round, and you've got 3 out of those in your team, you kind of hope that one of them had pulled out that outstanding round out that's going to get you a place or potentially even a win. I mean, even Dunn, who's sitting in 7th place going into the final day, I think he was 5 back, and you know, we've seen him before when he won at close house. I think he shot 61 that final round, and you know he's capable of doing that. You know, his putter is capable of being absolutely red hot, but just didn't happen. You know, it's a shame, because from the position I was in early on, it was looking quite good. And even Andre Lauty, that were part of the top 20, he shot 7 under in the first round, so he was right in the right in position. But again, that just started to fall to pieces and didn't make it through to the Sunday. In the end, he was another one who got cut after 54 holes, as was the format of the tournament. But yeah, I think there's some positives to take out of it anyway. I think I read the tournament reasonably well, just didn't quite get the result. And David Law, I mean, if you've managed to pick him out, then very well done to you. 300 to 1 he was, and I've seen some Betfair screenshots of 1,000 to 1, either pre-event or early in the actual event itself. So some people clearly did manage to pick him out and get a result. So well done to you guys if you did.
Well done to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before we go on to the events this week, it's worth mentioning that we're recording our first Masters podcast on Wednesday, and Barry O'Hanrahan's going to be involved.
Yeah.
So we're looking forward to it ever so much. We're planning, I think there'll be effectively three podcasts. There'll be the one that we're about to do that focuses on the anti-post markets and gives some real background around what kind of player characteristics we want, trends from previous years, best bookmaker offers, blah, 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 blah. Then the week before the Masters, we'll have another podcast where we're really starting to get down into the detail, you know, how the course is likely to play and our views. And then, of course, the actual week of the Masters itself. But when you've got a tournament that is so important and so popular, it'd be churlish not to to talk about it a bit more than a regular event. So that's going to be the first one of those is on Wednesday. So it'll either be out on Wednesday afternoon UK time or potentially Thursday morning.
Yeah.
Right. PGA Tour, Genesis Open. So the old Northern Trust Open was played at Riviera Country Club, which is a beautiful, classical, old style golf course in Los Angeles. And if you listen to this for a field, Dustin Johnson, McIlroy, Thomas, Rahm, DeChambeau, Bubba, Xander, who's already got two wins this year on the PGA Tour, Tiger Woods, whose actual charity foundation organised this event, Phil Mickelson, that 33-1 has just gone, Paul, that's 25s now, Jordan Spieth, Matsuyama, Casey Cantley, Finau, Kuchar, Leishman, Scott, it's loaded. Cam Smith, Tommy Fleetwood at 40s. And then we're out to the likes of Oosthuizen, Garcia at 50-1. Let's hope he behaves himself. So it's an absolutely cracking field. We've even got like the likes of Rafa Cabrera, Bello at 66s, Hatton at 80s. You know, you've got good players at prices you don't normally see them at.
Yeah. So Cameron Champ at 100-1 currently, and I remember
Champ, yeah.
You know, back end of last year, and after he won that event, and a lot of people say, "Well, you would never see decent prices about Cameron Champ." Is such a
A
talent. But yeah, as you said, this field is absolutely stacked, isn't it? And undoubtedly it's. It's going to push some of their prices out of some of these players. And 100-1 is quite a tempting number looking at that, I must say.
He's a good player for 100-1, isn't he?
Mm.
And actually, he did better at Pebble last week than I thought he would. In the end, I think he came in like top 35 or something.
Yeah.
And, sometimes especially on a three-course format, you could, as a young talented player, that can all become far too much.
Well, yeah.
But, especially when he's... At the end of the day, Riviera, I mean, it's worth getting into the detail. Classical, undulating golf course. You'll hear a lot of this week about the Kikuyu grass. So it shares Kikuyu grass with Torrey Pines in terms of the PGA Tour. And of course, Kikuyu grass is quite common in Australia, South Africa. So, you've got a lot of leaderboards. Charles Schwartzel's done well around here.
Yep.
Adam Scott's almost won around here. There's some good links to Antipodean or Southern Hemisphere golfers.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel like a long golf course when you look at the raw numbers. It's 7,300 yards and it's a par 71. And that doesn't really, shout to you, it's a real bomber's course. But when you look at the actual setup at the course, I'm just getting my my scorecard in. The first hole is a 503-yard par 5, which is the shortest par 5 of the year. And then, of course, you've got the famous drivable, allegedly, par 4 10th, which is 315 yards. So on the basis that's a par 5 and a par 4, the rest of the, 7,322 yards, it is quite a lengthy golf course for the other 16 holes.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, mid to high 450, 470-yard par 4s. You know, you've got par threes that are all around the 200-yard mark. The fourth is 236 for a par three. There's a short par three to 166 yards for the 16th, which is a bit of a devil. The closing hole is nigh on 500 yards, par four. So, don't... I think the way I'd explain it is that you have got shorter winners that have got the job done around here, but they really do have to be playing an absolutely unbelievable kind of level. Adam Scott, of course, has won here at Riviera back in 2005.
Yeah, 2005.
I knew I'd made a mistake. But you've also had Aaron Baddeley win around here. So, yeah, and Robert Allenby, of all people.
Yeah.
So, yes, that Kikuyu grass link is quite a good one. Yeah. But Allenby used to be, you know, in the old day, long, straight, high GIR.
Yeah, exactly. You can kind of correlate him and Adam Scott into that kind of, you know, in terms of ball strike and very, very similar kind of mould, aren't they? Presumably, if some of the shorter hitters have managed to do well here, it's probably been on years where it's been firmer and faster. If it's soft and, as you say, it's, you know, pretty lengthy in terms of the true scorecard anyway, then it's not going to appeal to the shorter players. I'm sure of that.
Greens here are a mix of bent grass and poana. So you're probably... There's bent grass in there, so they're a mix. They're not pure poa like we saw last week, which does help some players that can actually putt on a mixed surface, although they may struggle on pure poa. The greens themselves are around about 5,000 square feet. So they're bigger than last week, but that's not saying a great deal. The actual mix is creeping bent and poana. Tend to run fast on the stim, and this course really can be a devil. If you go back to the year that James Harm won, which I think was 2015, and also last year, 2018... the course was firm, fast and particularly fiery. Mm. I don't think we're going to see that this year, but we'll go into a little bit more detail in a short while. It's also a Tom Fazio design. So one of the things that we've added to this week's predictor model for the Genesis Open is a set of results that are based around Fazio designs or redesigns over the last 5 years. So that's interesting.
Yep.
And of course, that tends to throw up the same names, a Bubba Watson, a Dustin Johnson. So that's worth looking at in terms of the predictor model, the Fazio variable this week. Because some of his courses, I was actually slightly surprised. Quail Hollow, of course, we know. He also redesigned Merion when Justin Rose won in 2013, the US Open. He also, lo and behold, redesigned Oakmont where Dustin Johnson won the 2016 US Open. So you can see a lot of carryover here.
Yeah.
Conway Farms as well, the BMW Championship, 13, 15 and 17. And also the Seaside course where they play the RSM Classic every year. So quite a lot of Fazio redesigns out there. And you do get certain names popping up on a lot of those designs across them.
Yeah, certainly.
Which would suggest that they like that kind of the features that he puts on a course.
Yeah, the names, you know, a lot of them seem to be similar kind of mould, don't they? Ball strikers, longer ball strikers. So perhaps there's some commonality between those courses that drives that kind of player.
As you said, though, it's a real pure classical course. And with a classical course, you often get two kinds of winner. You get pure ball striker, or you get a guy that's got a fantastic short game that, in a certain setup, i.e. firm and fast, everybody's struggling to hit greens.
Yep.
And they can get plenty of up and downs and keep right in the actual the competition. I'm not sure that's going to happen this year. For me, I think Riviera plays long anyway. And the weather has been... Well, we saw at Pebble Beach last week, and Pebble Beach isn't a million miles away from Riviera in Los Angeles. The golf course here has had quite a lot of rain over the last 3 to 4 days.
Yeah.
When I've actually gone back into my notes, they've taken on board almost 370 millimetres of rain since the start of December, and that's a lot more than you used to see here. Take it last year, they'd only seen 38 millimetres over the same 2.5 month period.
It's 10 times. That's mad, isn't
it? Yes, it's at 367 this particular year. So, I think it's all going to be about bombers. It's all going to be about the long irons. It's all going to be about ball strikers. But clearly, if you can find a ball striker in an elite mould who not only can hit the ball and hit lots of greens, but he's a good scrambler as well and a good ball shaper. I think there's a common idea here that faders prosper at Riviera, the left to right ball flight.
Yeah.
And you can see that. But if you can find a ball striker that can move the ball both ways.
Yeah, which explains Bubba, doesn't it? Because Bubba clearly loves this loves this course.
Creative golfer.
Yeah.
So we're looking at a soft, sopping wet golf course, as we saw last week. I think it's going to be the longer, higher hitters that thrive this week. I really do. And when you just look at previous winners around here, I mean, clearly it's fairly obvious, isn't it? We've got Bubba Watson's won three times since 2014. We've had DJ win in 2017. I was on him. And we had DJ finish second even in 2015, the year where we had Hahn at a crazy big price win.
Yeah.
I'm looking... If you just look at the records of those guys as they were arriving at Riviera, they were striking the ball fantastically off the tee from a strokes gained off the tee perspective. And in the main, they were ranking very, very highly in terms of complete strokes gained tee to green, which would suggest they also had a bit of a short game where they were actually, making gains around the greens as well.
Yeah, makes sense.
So that's the kind of mould I'm looking at. It's difficult to get into real detail on the basis that markets are only just coming up and I haven't been able to run all my full analysis that I'd want to on the basis that the AT&T Pebble Beach has just finished. But my opening thoughts around this are, if I was looking at players, we've got Dustin Johnson at 8-9-1, which isn't the most generous of prices, but we know that DJ loves the format. There's a potential question mark about whether he's playing the best golf at the moment. And if you're looking at someone at 8-9-1, really you want to make sure that everything that you'd want to see is physically there.
Yeah.
And just his performance last week. You know, when I backed him 2 years ago, he just finished third at Pebble Beach and a fast finishing third, yeah? He came here the next week and he absolutely annihilated field on the soft golf course. I don't know if I saw enough from DJ last week to suggest that he's in the top form of his life at the moment.
No, although you've got to bear in mind, he'd just won in Saudi.
Just got off jet lag and whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
So he's come straight. You know, he loves Pebble, doesn't he? So could he have set that aside and got over that? It's difficult to tell, isn't it? It is difficult to tell. But he played, he did some really good stuff in Saudi. I know, the field that he beat there isn't the field that you've got here, even though there were some top names there. I think this is a deeper field. So it's a tough one. And that's why you're getting 9-1 rather than kind of the sixes and sevens that we've seen over other weeks. There's more for him to beat.
15-2 last week?
Yeah, around
sixes,
that kind of
bracket. Sixes, wasn't he? Sixes, I saw sevens.
Yeah, but for a couple of weeks now, he's been that kind of level. But the field has pushed him out a little bit here. But certainly not to say that he can't win this. Not at all.
We then got kind of Rory McIlroy and Justin Thomas at 14s. If I was going to take one of those, bearing in mind Justin Thomas is one of my favourite players, right at this point of time, I'd probably take McIlroy.
Yep.
I think McIlroy's playing some really good stuff at the moment. And one thing that comes to mind here, just looking back at the winners here, this is just the kind of situation that winners have been in. Take Bubba last year. Bubba hadn't won for 2 years here, and he won at 50-1. Clearly, his previous win, guess where? He'd been it.
Yep.
You then go to Dustin Johnson in 2017. He hadn't won since the BMW Championship the previous year, so 5 months. Bubba in 2016 had won Tiger's Challenge in the early December. But see, what I'm suggesting here is that we haven't got players here that have actually won in the calendar year that they've won this tournament.
Yeah.
James Hahn, well, he'd never won a PGA Tour event. Bubba Watson in 2014. He hadn't won since the Masters in 2012. John Merrick, a non-winner. Bill Haas. Well, Bill Haas in 2012 when he won this. He'd won the Tour Championship in 2011. Aaron Baddeley, he won him in 2011. He hadn't won for 4 years. So even though you could look at this field and you could say, well, John Rahm's been playing, Bryson DeChambeau's been playing some great stuff. He's actually physically won this year, which is a bit of an off point looking at those numbers. Xander Schauffele, again, been playing some great stuff. Nice, reasonable prices available out there, 22-1, maybe a little bit of 25-1. I'm not suggesting that Xander won't feature. I'm not suggesting that he can't win around here. But if you just go off that trend, you don't tend to get players that have already won two times on the PGA Tour just rocking up here and winning.
No,
that's just the kind of way it is.
I wonder, you know, if you've already got that win to your name for the season, you've got the Masters coming up, you know, are you looking to get your game right and to peak again in April rather than, you know, feeling the need to win again now? And it's difficult to know how deep the golfers really think about it. And, you know, I'm not suggesting that some of them go out and deliberately don't try to win.
I know it's a conscious thing. It's just a biorhythm thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Whereas some of them who haven't got a win will feel that they need to kind of validate their form and to validate the game over the next few weeks to know they're in the kind of shape that they can go and contend when it gets to the Masters. It's an interesting trend. I mean, you talk about McIlroy. You know, one thing we know he absolutely loves is a sopping wet golf course, and if it's gonna be as you know, as wet as you've described in terms of the amount of rain that he's taken over the last few weeks, then that could play right to his strengths.
I also think course experience is important here. Now you look at John Rahm. We know John's been playing some awesome stuff. We know that he plays well at Torrey Pines. Mm. We know, but he's 16-1, and he's never played the golf course.
Yeah.
And I just genuinely think to win here, yes, you get your Thomas Peters that came second here a couple of years ago, but Thomas Peters wasn't a 16-1 shot. I think Thomas Peters was more of a 100-1 shot.
Yeah.
And that's built into the price, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, 100-1, you might take the chance if.
Sorry, Thomas Peters, I've got it. 125-1.
Yeah.
Now you're not getting out at a 16-1 shot in John Rahm, are you?
No. And you know, there's an expectation that Rahm's, you know, already at that level above, and he's going to be able to compete and contend on, you know, pretty much wherever he goes. And again, you know, a long soft golf course would kind of play to his strengths. I don't think it's going to play particularly tough by the sounds of it. What's the wind expected to be? It's not excessive, the wind, is it?
We're talking Monday as ever. I mean, I was looking at it this morning. There is going to be some wind on Thursday, apparently. I mean, I'll have a close look in the morning, see how the forecast delivered. Mm. Could be gusting up to 20 miles an hour Thursday. Could be gusting up to 25, 30 miles an hour on Sunday. So take that as you will. It's going to still be a soft golf course because I think there's going to be rain definitely on Wednesday in the week and looking very likely during play Thursday morning as well.
Yeah.
There could actually be, I mean, if this forecast came to fruition, they're saying rain on Thursday morning. They're also saying winds up to 20 miles an hour and then the wind dies completely.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if there's a suspension of play on Thursday, looking at the forecast. So it's difficult to say that late early would get a break. You might find they haul them off after a couple of hours and the course is underwater.
Yeah.
You just don't know, do you?
Nah,
how can you second guess it?
I don't think you can you?
But, you know, the trend I was telling you about with DJ and Watson.
These are
Rory's numbers. Bearing in mind, Rory's now focused purely on the PGA Tour. He's played at Kapalua, where he made his debut. Strokes gained off the tee first. Strokes gained tee to green sixth. He then went to Torrey Pines, which I think, from memory, was another course debut, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
So he finished fourth in Kapalua. He then finished fifth at Torrey Pines. And we know pure power he struggles on, sure enough. 55th for strokes gained putting. But third for strokes gained off the tee, and also ninth for strokes gained total tee to green. He was 11th for strokes gained around the green. And I always feel in my mind that when Rory's hitting the ball straighter than he usually does, yeah, hitting more fairways, that's when he starts coming to the fore, when he's got confidence in that driver.
Well, if he's hitting fairways and it's a soft golf course and his irons can just land exactly where he wants them to land, then he's a dangerous beast, isn't he?
Now, you could say, oh, his record here isn't very good. Yes, he's played here twice, and he's finished in the top 20 twice. And actually, on debut, and we were saying it's a tough course to get your head round first time round, he was actually in fourth place entering Sunday.
Yep.
And then he just blew up. But that, again, was a year where James Harm won, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So when the course was actually... Or it was certainly a setup, I think, where it was constantly getting firmer and firmer and firmer. I'm not sure we're going to get that this year. I think it could be soft the whole way through, and that really does play to McIlroy's strengths. And don't forget, it hasn't won since Bay Hill last year on either tour.
Yep.
So he'll be hungry, very, very hungry. His numbers last year around here, fourth for strokes gained off the tee. He was 22nd for strokes gained tee to green. I think he's got the game. And I've just read comments from around him saying, his words were, I can see why Bubba plays well around here because he's got such a creative, aggressive mentality.
Mm.
And he says, if you look at the golf courses I play well at, they're exactly the same as Bubba's.
Yep.
And that's their his own words. So I think there might be something in Rory this week if I was going to take someone from the very top.
Yeah, there's a lot of positives.
I'm tempted. I would rather take him than Thomas and Rahm this week.
Mm-hmm.
And probably DeChambeau as well. Who are all about priced at the same.
Yeah, all in that kind of bracket, aren't they? What about Bubba?
My real dilemma, Paul, is whether I back Bubba Watson.
Yeah, he's a difficult one, isn't he? You know, he clearly loves Riviera. Defending, I don't think he's not defended in his career as yet, has he? But he's this kind of player who he loves the courses that he loves. If he's comfortable and happy on a particular track, then he tends to perform year in, year out, doesn't he? And three wins here, it speaks for itself, doesn't it?
He seems quite relaxed. I mean, I saw that podcast he did and he was relaxed in that. He seemed quite relaxed in Phoenix the other week. I mean, listen to these numbers. Phoenix, strokes gained off the tee, first. Strokes gained approach, seventh. Strokes gained tee to green, first.
Yeah.
Strokes gained putting, 56th. But that doesn't matter. This isn't a putting fest, it won't be. And he knows exactly where he needs to put his approaches and he can read those bent Poana greens perfectly. That's his favourite surface, the mix of the Poa and the bent.
And this is where the comfort level comes in. He knows his long game's in decent nick and he turns up to a course where he feels comfortable and confident on the greens. He can read the greens, he can read the grass. He knows the different nuances of the way that the course is set up and the greens are set and... You know, it all kind of slots into place. Now, it clearly doesn't slot into place every year because you know he's had some poor efforts here. But to won three out of the last five attempts here is, he clearly loves it, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's never defended, and that's a real downside. You can't say anything but that.
Mm.
But. You know, if we're seeing a happy Bubba and he's in a decent space, and it was interesting that he has gone quite close when defending here.
Yep.
I'm just bringing the stats up on the system. When he defended here in 20... It was the first time. So it was 2015. That was the year when it was really firm and fast that Harm won.
Yep.
He was sixth. He was sixth at halfway. Sixth at 54 holes. So it's not as if he hasn't been in contention when defending.
No, and he's not completely blown up when defending, has he? It's just hasn't happened yet. But
he is playing some brilliant stuff right now, and he knows every nook and cranny. I don't think it being a soft golf course is going to do him any harm either.
No.
We then get to the likes of Xander, who we just kind of discussed. I mean, I like him for this, but I'm not sure he's actually stroking the ball as well as you'd probably want to see. But he just seems to pop up when he wants to. Whether he thinks the Genesis Open is a huge tournament, and that's when he seems to come to the fore, isn't it? Big, big tournaments. I don't know. Tiger Woods is playing 20-1 generally available. He has not got the greatest of records here.
Yeah,
I get the feeling. It's funny that, but he just hasn't ever played this golf course at all well. never won here.
I was just flicking through his record here a little bit earlier, and I saw that he played played Riviera last year. But you've got to go all the way back to the Nissan Open, haven't you, to get any course form from him? And you know, given his dominance back in the days that he was playing the Nissan, for him not to have won.
Mm. 1999 was the year he was runner up.
Yeah, a couple more top tens, didn't he, over the years? But
and he came here 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006. Clearly, he's a Los Angeles boy. He never played here between 2006 and last year.
Yeah,
which tells you that he doesn't want to play the golf course.
Mm.
And you know, and the idea with Tiger is, and it's true, we know with Tiger, we know what courses he plays well on, and you know where he's going to contend. And I don't think it's this week. That's not to say that he doesn't come into the picture for next week, which is the Honda Classic. And I think clearly Bay Hill, 12 months on from where he really broke out last year.
Mm.
I don't know if he'll play Cobhead, but that Florida swing is, I think, where his Tiger will start to peak for Augusta.
Yeah, we shall see.
And let's face it, he knows how to do it, doesn't he?
Mm.
And then we've got the likes of Mickelson at 25-1. I can't back Jordan Spieth. 25-1 is getting a better price, but you don't find the layers seem to be putting... I don't think you're getting the prices on Spieth and the way that he's playing that you should be getting. You should be getting a lot bigger than 25-1, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Got in the mix again last week. But, you know, I think he was in the top 50 for greens in regulation again.
Yeah.
Now, that, around Riviera on a sopping wet golf course, that isn't going to work.
No. There's something there, isn't there? As you say, he was... He showed some form early on in the event, but
I think he got to within one or two in the lead, sort of Saturday afternoon, and then he started doubles and triples.
Yeah, doesn't help, does it?
Yeah, would suggest there's something quite ingrained in there where, you know, if he's not going to contend around Pebble Beach, and that's the perfect kind of setup for him.
Yeah.
I don't fancy his chances this week. Matsuyama at 30s looks quite tempting, but having been on him at Phoenix, where he did finish top tee to green, it was his driving that was shockingly bad.
Yeah. And we kind of touched on it before,
That doesn't feel great for here, does it?
His irons, and we saw it before, didn't we? His irons seem to be strong, but off the tee, he's not quite right, is it? Not quite right at the moment. And when he gets that right, he's going to be winning tournaments. I think the rest of his game's pretty much there.
I'm not so sure that you can be 100% flagrant off the tee here.
No.
And you've also got to be a guy that's very comfortable moving the ball both ways.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that Hideki isn't that man, but I don't think he's got the confidence in his driver right now to actually be moving the ball left to right and right to left, because he's missing it both ways.
Yeah.
And around here, that means block shots. I think if we're looking at courses that really link in well here, Kapalua is obvious with both Dustin Johnson and Watson. But there's weird courses like the PGA West where they play the Humana Challenge. James Harnes finished fourth there. Bubba Watson's been runner up there. John Merrick's been runner up there. Bill Haas has won there twice. You see, Steve Stricker's finished runner up at PGA West. So that's a bit of a strange one.
That is an odd one, though.
But it seems to come out quite regularly. Glen Abbey for the RBC Canadian Open. DJ's finished twice there and won there. James Harnes finished top 12 there. Yeah. Bubba Watson's finished runner-up there. That's a classical golf course.
There's a bit more logic than
that used to feature a bit of bent grass with Poana mixed in with it. So you can see that one.
Yeah.
Conway Farms, another good link. Cog Hill, BMW Championship. There are courses. And listen, Doral. DJ's won at Doral. Bubba's finished second there twice and third. Phil Mickelson, who's won here twice at Riviera, has won at Doral. Now, they don't play there anymore. But, you know, that's three players that have played exceedingly well at Doral that go well round here virtually every year. So there's something linking that to it as well. That's quite a positive for Rory, because Rory, I think, has finished second and third at Doral.
Mm.
Never quite won. Justin Rose has done well here at Riviera. He won at Doral. So there's something in that. Garcia, another one. But, yeah, I mean, players in the mid-range that potentially interest me. Finau, Cantlay. I think Leishman, although I think Leishman's tee to green game starting to desert him a little bit. Adam Scott, I think he's going to be a decent shout at 33s. In my opinion, I didn't think he would ever do a lot last week because it is pure. It's a putter's paradise, Pebble Beach.
Yeah.
In the main, you know, Schnedeker, Leishman, they've played well there. Of course, Phil. Jason Day plays well there. Good, very comfortable putters. Not Adam Scott.
Yeah.
But here, based on the fact that he was second at Torrey Pines a few weeks ago, and he's kept himself in... He did disgrace himself. He made the feed. He just didn't make the final cut.
Yeah.
And noticeably with Scott, he actually drove the ball well on his one round at Pebble Beach. Because clearly there was only strokes gained information gleaned at Pebble Beach last week. But he was in the top 15 for strokes gained across his on his only round.
Yeah. I'm not sure you can read a great deal into last week with a lot of players, to be honest. You know, looking back at his Torrey Pines effort is far stronger, I think. You know, he kind of married that up to how he's played in the past.
Runner-up a couple of years ago to Bubba.
Yeah.
Are you in on Scott at that price?
Scott's the only player that I've backed today.
I was waiting for the
price to come up. You know, we talked about Scott back a couple of weeks ago, and you know,
well, you picked him up at hundreds, didn't you? Before Torrey Pines, finished second,
exactly. And you know, looking through the list of potential matches in terms of, you know, matching him to his skill sets to the tracks that are coming up, this was one that sticks out like a sore thumb. And I got a little bit of early 45s earlier on, 45-1, which I thought was. Which I thought was on the generous side, and I think he will settle around about 33s, as you just said, which is probably around about the right price for him. But 45-1, I'm willing to have a chance at that price, I think.
That second place finish at Torrey 3 weeks ago, 15th for greens in regulation, 8th for scrambling, fantastic for this week, yeah, a place like Riviera. He was 6th, equal 6th with Tony Finau for ball striking. Made 7 bogeys, and the Rory McIlroy topped it that week. He only made 5. So yep. Scott's in great nick. Very, very good nick. That missed cut actually boosts his price, because he clearly would have been shorter if he'd had a very strong week at Pebble.
Yeah, exactly. And he started off the third round in decent shape as well. And you know, towards the end of it, he just kind of drifted away a bit. The conditions weren't good, were they? And you know, by that point, he was quite a long way off the lead. You know, did you take a tactical... Sunday
at a pro-am as well.
Yeah, do you take a tactical Sunday off and get yourself prepped for an event that's going to be far up your alley rather than Pebble Beach? Yeah. Not a bad miscut.
I thought you were talking about Amsterdam again for a short while. Anyway, we won't go down that route. Stallings appeals to me, as we said, kind of bloke that keeps the heat, loves the power. Finished 30, I think, last year.
Yep.
So he's one that interests me. Keegan Bradley, another triple-digit price. Luke List's likely to do well around here. You could make a case for Danny Willett. Plays well at Augusta. Definitely shows something at Torrey Pines. Didn't make many bogeys, so he's keeping the card clean. The other one that did jump out at me, and this is kind of very tentative, and I don't even know if I'll actually tip him, could be a very good DraftKings play, for example.
Mm.
And I mentioned him to you off mic, and you were like, Johnny Vegas.
Yep. Yeah, no, he's playing some off
great stuff. Great record at Glen Abbey, and we talked about this quirky PGA West link. Well, he won there, where he beat Gary Woodland many years ago. Can play a classical golf course. And his performance last time out at Scottsdale was very, very eye-catching. Mm. He was 4th for greens in regulation. He was 18th for ball striking. He was 3rd for scrambling. And he only made 4 bogeys, which was equal with Xander Schauffele and Sung Jae-im. So they were the 3 players that made the least bogeys over 72 holes.
Yep.
So I think Vegas, who I'm seeing as big as 250-1, and he's going to be a real steal in the DraftKings price strategy. I think that's a decent price.
If the price,
am I imagining that he's had a top 10 here in the past?
Let's have a quick
In the top 20 last year around here, and he was 12th here in 2011.
Right.
So not a total disaster.
No. No, I think if the scoring's a little bit easier, it's softer, as you said. You know, he's got the ammunition to get around a soft golf course, that's for sure.
So, he's definitely a bomber.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Johnny Vegas. I might try and squeeze him in at a big price. But that's where I'm at. I can't be any more specific than that, listeners, I'm afraid, because that's just the way that the cookies crumbled this week with the Pebble Beach having to be extended by another 15 hours into Monday. So I will be out with my preview as quickly as I can tomorrow morning UK time, and also with the Golf Betting Show. The Golf Betting Show for Paul's event is already out there, so that's available on our YouTube channel. I'll build a link into the podcast description for that. And Paul, you have an event, a second week in a row in Australia on the European Tour. It all makes sense, doesn't it? You're at the ISPS Handa World Super 6.
Yeah.
Which actually has been on the European Tour longer than you might think, hasn't it?
Well, the actual the course has been played for a few different events over the years. But
didn't they used to play this in the autumn as we know it, which is early spring back then? But it's now clearly we're playing it now in our very late winter, which is coming into their summer, yeah?
Yeah, it used to be the Johnny Walker Classic going back to the early 2000s. Yeah, so it was Retief Goosen and Ernie Els.
Right.
In fact, Ernie Els set the scoring record for the European Tour here back in the day at 29 under. So that kind of
Ernie going to pop out, Paul? Because he's playing. So he played again well last week, Ernie Els.
Yeah. It's a difficult one to call.
Can you see him popping up at something European Tour level? Or Florida makes perfect sense because he's got a great record on the Bermuda.
Yeah. Can he compete?
He's playing a lot better golf, mate.
Can he compete and contend at that kind of level anymore, do you think?
Don't know.
It's a tough one, isn't it? But yeah, no, you're right. He's been prominent at various points, hasn't he?
He's eating tons of greens, which is always, of course, his strength. Sorry, I interrupt you. Go on, mate.
No, he's an interesting one because his name has been popping up. But yeah, so we played used to play the Johnny Walker Classic here at Lake Carinyup. The Perth International, which was when it was resurrected, or the course was resurrected to be used for European Tour action. So that was 2012, I think it was, when Bo van Pelt came over and won. And they played it for a few years, and then the last 2 years, and this will be the third year, it's been converted into this World Super 6 format. So the European Tour do love these quirky, different format events, and this is the first one of those this season. I'll go through how it works, because it is complex.
I should know. I've been covering it for 3 years, but you had to remind me how it actually works.
Yeah, so Thursday and Friday, it's pretty straightforward. 36 holes of stroke play, so 18 each day, as you'd expect, as normal. The cut's 65 and ties, so nothing changes there. They then go into Saturday, where they play another 18 holes of stroke play. And at the end of Saturday, the field is cut down to 24 players. So if there's more than 24 players on the cut line at that point, they'll have a mass playoff to see who gets through. And then the top and the final 24 will go through to Sunday. And that's where it all changes, because instead of it being stroke play, it turns into match play. The top 8 in the leaderboard as of Sunday morning get a bye into the second round, and the other 16 will play each other in the first round, so that you end up with 8 who get through, who then play the 8 top seeds who finish in the top 8 positions on the leaderboard. And the way this match play works, it's 6-hole match play. They'll go through the 6 holes. There's one after the end of 6 holes clearly goes through. If there's a tie, then they proceed to the knockout hole, which is around about 100 yards in length. And they'll play that until there's a winner of that particular match. So these are short, sharp, 6-hole match play games and matches that, it's a lot of fun actually to watch it. It can be quite a challenge to bet on, but then I picked up Brett Rumford the first year that this ran.
50 to 1,
that was very nice. I put Brett Rumford up again as first round leader last year on Facebook, and uh, he shot a lovely first round, and that kept me ticking over for the week. I'd Rumford outright as well that week, and he ended up missing the cup from the final group on the Saturday. But that's the way this game goes sometimes, isn't it? So the course itself is a 7,143-yard par 72. It's a classical tree-lined affair. But it is quite wide. The fairway's around about 40 yards wide. And, you know, for a classical tree-lined track, it's not going to play, you know, it's not going to play like a Valderrama. It's not tight like that. It's more about how players perform from the second shot in. It's about high GIR. If you're missing greens, the scrambling is particularly tough around this track. So there's runoffs, the bunkers are nasty. The pin positions can be particularly challenging if the organisers decide to tuck them away. And what you get here, being on the Perth, it's just inside the Perth coastline. It's a couple of miles off the coast, and you get this what's called the Fremantle Doctor, the wind that comes in off the Perth coast every day in the afternoons, and it can really make it a challenging course to play when there's a bit of wind around. Now, you've actually got a bit of wind around generally this week anyway, so Thursday it's going to be averaging around about 20 miles an hour, which I think is going to make it really quite tricky. Friday's it's down to about 10, and then Saturday, Sunday, 15, maybe again up to 20 miles an hour in terms of the wind speed. So I think it's going to be quite challenging. Of course, by Sunday they'd be playing match play, so it's going to be, you know, it's less about the score that's being made and more about how you're playing against the other player. But you clearly need to get yourself into position over the first 3 days, and if you're playing poorly in the wind, it's not going to happen, is it? So
no.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Going back to some of these old events, just to give you an idea of the kind of players that won or have won. So I said Bo van Pelt won the 2012 Perth International.
Proper GIR grinder Bo van Pelt was, as Louis Oosthuizen is, so yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. But you've also got players like Jin Jong. He won at 250-1 the year after.
Mm-hmm.
Where has Jin Jong gone, eh?
I haven't a clue. It did make me chuckle when I read his name.
Olsen won in 2014 at 40-1. Jin Jong was 250-1, by the way. Oosthuizen, you said, won in 2016 at 10-1. And then Brett Rumford, when it converted to this Super 6 format, he won at 50s. Last year was Afi Barnrat at 25-1. So when we've moved to this Super 6 format, you've got two very, very strong putters who've come away with the title, so Rumford and Afi Barnrat. But this kind of throws up a dilemma then. How do you play this event? Because you've got two different ways you can play it. And I've gone into a little bit of detail on the preview, but you've got markets for the overall winner, which are...
A link in the description box, listeners, by the way. There is a link there to both of our previews this week. So if you want to read Paul's in detail, you can click through.
Yeah, so it probably does take a bit of digesting. And actually, within the preview itself, I put a link through to the format page of the actual official website that goes into the same kind of detail, but just to kind of validate that. So you've got two different markets running on this. You've got an outright market, which, because it's match play, the bookies go top four. So to get through to the semi-finals is where you're getting paid out each way.
Yeah.
Most of the bookies, in fact, all of the bookies but one, have gone a quarter of the odds of the top four. Boyle Sports, so the only bookie right now who have gone something slightly different, and they're offering a third of the odds of the top four. Now, if you put that into your calculator, that actually means you're getting a third extra on your each-way payout if you go a third the odds rather than a quarter of the odds. So, in short, if you're betting the outright market and your odds are the same with Boyle Sports for the player you've chosen as everyone else, then use Boyles because you're going to get a better each-way payout should they get through to the semi-finals. And that's, of course, if you want to play the match play market, so the outright market for the guy who's actually going to lift the trophy on Sunday night. The alternative is to play the 54-hole leader market, so you can draw a line under the event after the three rounds of match or straight play have been played, and some bookmakers are offering a market there. And again, the odds are actually quite similar, but you're getting the more conventional terms, sort of 5 or 6 or sometimes 7 places each way, depending on the bookmaker you use. You can choose to play the event that way. And I guess, you know, looking back, when I picked Rumford up in 2017, he was 5 shots clear after the first 3 rounds. So had he not gone on to win that event, I'd have been absolutely screwing, because, you know, I've backed him. He's played the best golf of all of the players there. He's 5 shots clear after 3 rounds. And he could have lost in the first round, and I'd have gone away, walked away with absolutely nothing there. As it happened, he continued and he won the event. Last year, Prom Meswat, who was the 54-hole leader, he did lose his first match play event the following day. He clearly got a bye through to the second round, and then he lost that match. So anyone who'd backed Meswat outright would have been let down. Now, had they backed him for 54-hole leader, they'd have walked away with a winner. So there's a dilemma as to how you play it. And, you know, you can back one or the other. You could back 54, you could back outright, you could back both, depending how you see, you know, how your attitude is to kind of the risk that you've got with this kind of event, I guess. The flip side of that is Afi Barnrat, who he only just scraped through to the match play part last year. He was tied for 17. They had to have a playoff to get through to the Sunday. He made it through that, and then he wins the event. So had you have backed him in the 54-hole leader market, you'd have got absolutely nothing back. But he goes on and lifts the trophy. So there is a bit of a punter's dilemma with this particular event. So I've kind of circumvented that by going for both markets with the 3 players that I've picked. So rather than going for 4, 5, 6 players and backing them all in the outright market or backing them all in the 54-hole leader market, I've picked 3 that I think are good value, and I've backed them in both the 54-hole leader market and the outright market. And if they were to oblige on one or the other of the markets, then clearly we get a winner. Best case scenario is we end up with a 54-hole leader and the outright winner, and end up with bagging 2 winners for the week. But let's cross that bridge when we get there. That would be a nice...
From what you're saying, and it does make a lot of sense, doesn't it? You're better off having less players covering both markets.
I think, yeah, I remember last year, I think I backed it most, if not all of my players in the outright market. And then you kind of get part of the way through the week and you're thinking, you know, I wish I'd have backed him in the 54-hole leader market now, because, you know, there's a chance of it being... You know, there being a serious letdown here. So it offers you some protection against that. But yes, you know, unless you're going to, you know, end up backing 5 or 6 players and then doubling your overall stake or halving your stake to kind of accommodate it.
Yeah.
It takes a little bit of thought. So yeah, the way I've played it is I've gone for 3 and I've backed them in both markets. The first of my 3 is I'm sticking with Paul Dunne. I backed Dunne last week and he did all right. He was 7th into Sunday. He certainly had a chance. I think he was 5 back and nothing happened on the Sunday. He shot 73. He only made one birdie in the whole day and nothing dropped for him. But I think he knows he's close. I've, you know, read some of the Twitter comments from himself and, you know, he's taken a lot of positives out of the week. And the thing that really stands out to me, and I've mentioned it before with Paul Dunne, is so much of this comes down to how he drives. And he has been driving the ball really poorly for quite some time now. But last week, I think he finished 15th overall for driving accuracy. And going into Sunday, he was 4th in the field, which is a revelation for him. You know, that's the kind of number that I'm looking out for with a player like him. And you know, when that's popping up on my screen, and that's a signal to get involved. I mean, he was 2nd for scrambling. The putter wasn't quite there, but I think he still finished around about 20th for putting average on the week, which you know, when the putter fires with him, he can take a tenth off of that, and he can really contend. He's got a little bit of history here. He missed a cut back in 2016 on the only time that he's played it, but then he'd been playing out in America up until that point. He missed a cut in Phoenix, missed a cut in Pebble, came over here, missed a cut. Clearly wasn't in the best of shape in terms of his form at the time, but you know, given that his form seems to be escalating in the right direction now, I think that's going to be
the thing that made tons of sense when I read your preview was, and the name Paul Dunn, is that the fairways are 40 yards wide.
Yeah, exactly.
And that brings him right into the mix.
He does like it wider. You know, any kind of second shot course where there's less emphasis off the tee shot and more about how you're going to play your wedges and your approach shots, and he's got a magical short game. He likes the classical tracks. We've seen him do well in Open Championship qualifying at the Woburn course that's here, not the one they use for the British Masters, the other track. He's done well there. Close house. He's finished. He lost out in a playoff in Morocco as well, which is another one of these tree lined but slightly wider tracks. I think there's a lot to like with him. And if you look at some of his match play form, he finished 10th at the World Cup with Shane Lowry. Clearly, Lowry's gone on to win in the last few weeks, so there might be a little bit of motivation there for Paul to emulate his compatriots. And then he won the Gulf Sixes last year with Gavin Moynihan as well. So, you know, if you're talking about quirky events, then you know, he's already got that on his CV. So, I thought 50-1 outright and 50-1 54-hole leader was worth a punt in this, again, which isn't a particularly strong field, I don't think.
Where did Louis Oosthuizen win his Open Championship?
It was 2010.
It was St Andrews, wasn't it?
It was St Andrews, yeah.
What? Yeah. Don't even barely have fairways, do they? And where did Paul Dunn come to the fore?
Yeah,
and I'm seeing here that he had a seventh in the Dunhill Links a couple of years ago as well. It does make a lot of sense.
Yeah. I think this will appeal to him. I do, and you know, I think the miscut in 2016, I think it can just be ignored. And I wouldn't be remotely surprised to see him go well this week. And if it is windy, that's fine. You know, it generally means that other players are going to be struggling from off the tee, and you know, that levels the playing field out for him. And
you've got to make a lot of putts, and we know he's a fantastic putter. Yeah. So yeah, absolutely.
If the putter's working on Sunday, then he can you can absolutely annihilate other players just by making putts from all angles. So yeah, I do like Dunn this week. I also like Adrian Ategui, who again, 50-1 outright, slightly longer, you're getting 55-1 in places in the 54-hole leader market. He missed the cut last week, or he missed the final round cut. He got through to the third round and it didn't make the final top 35 cut, but you know, there were 40-odd players who didn't make that either. If you look at his stats, he hit over 83% of greens in regulation, which is positive. He was 7th for GIR the week before in Saudi when he finished 24th. Again, he hit over 80% of fairways that week as well. And that's his game. I think when he's hitting fairways, it drives confidence through the rest of his game. And we saw that back end of last year, 3rd in Turkey, 4th at the Earth Course in Dubai. You know, clearly operating at a far higher level than this week's test. But I think the thing that really sticks out to me is the two wins that he's got on the European Tour. 2017 Paul Laurie match play, the 2018 Belgian knockout, which again is one of these quirky match play formats. Both of his wins have been in this kind of match play, so, you know, lower tier match play events on the European Tour, and I think he'll feel quite at home playing this week. I think it will be, you know, the format will feel good to him. His game's better than I think his underlying or his visible results really show. And again, I thought 50-1 was worth having a punt. And again, you're getting slightly more if you go for the 54.
I didn't realise that he had such a good close to last year. I didn't realise he was performing at such high echelons.
Yeah. Those top four finishes in Turkey and Dubai, they're strong. I mean, he only just made it into Dubai, but then to go and finish fourth is
absolutely.
That's a big move for him. You know, career wise, it's setting a marker down for what he can do in the future. Yeah. He's a good player. I do like Ategui. I think he's a good player, and you know, on any given week, he can hit a lot of greens. On any given week, he can make some putts, and those weeks that he ties it all together, he's a dangerous player. My final selection is. A lot of punters may not have really come across this guy, but it's Sinapa Chikarangappa, who's an Indian player who's been around for a little while. He's only 25, but he's starting to appear on some higher level leaderboards, and he's starting to rack up a pretty decent haul of wins for his career. Now, if you go back to 2016, we had Fletcher Kongwatmai, who was in the final. Yep. Against Brett Rumford, and
no one had ever heard of.
No, he's a young Thai guy. He'd kind of come through, and no one really heard about him. But he kind of snuck through to the final day, got himself all the way through to the final. Rumford ground him down at the end. But these things can happen, and I kind of see Chikarangappa in a similar kind of mould. Really, slightly older, he's 25, but at 25 years of age, he's already won 12 times on the Indian Tour, the PGTI. 10 of those wins came quite early in his career, and then he changed his swing, had a few challenges trying to adapt to that, and he didn't win anything then until November just gone, where he won Jeet Mukul Singh's Invitational Tournament, and then he won again last week, again on the Indian Tour, clearly playing some decent golf. Now, those are all pretty low level events, but then if you look, he finished second on that Mauritius Open, the one that was co-sanctioned with the European Tour that Kurt Kitayama won. And again, if you look down his skill stats, lots of good scrambling performances, a lot of good putting performances. Overall, in Singapore Open, he finished before he won last week. He finished kind of top 25, that kind of level. And his overall game looked pretty strong in what was a stronger field in Singapore. And I think there's quite a lot to like about him. And 200-1 outright and 175-1 for the 54-hole lead, again, I thought was just worth having a punt on in this particular format. And again, what's a pretty weak field. So those are the three that I've backed. The preview, as Steve said earlier, was out a little bit earlier this afternoon.
People mentioned they like guys that came close in terms of your shortlist. Are any players there that you kind of cut at the last, or you cut on the basis that you can't back them with this two market strategy? Is there anyone there that really jumps out?
Yeah, some of the guys at the top, it's very difficult to try and draw a line through them. I mean, Justin Harding's playing some excellent golf at the moment. Mm. Some really good golf.
He has been for a while, hasn't he?
He has, yeah. Brad Kennedy, again, he finished, I forget where it was last year, fifth last year, I think. He was second last week. I think he topped the predictor model as well, Brad, so I may regret that one. At the top end, Thomas Peters is very, very short, but then if you look at his winning the World Cup with Thomas Dietrich, you know, clearly there's some correlation there. And his form's not been bad. It's not been consistently good this season. But if you look at his overall finishes, I think he's got three top 30 finishes out of his three attempts in decent fields as well. So you can certainly make a case for him. But, you know, the kind of prices on offer there, it's I couldn't take it. I guess the guy that I think is probably playing the best golf of the lot is Tom Lewis. He's been playing some really cracking golf, but you know, 16-1 in this format of field, I just can't get excited.
There's a lot of ifs and buts there for a 16-1 shot, isn't there?
There is, yeah, there is. Mm. I think the way to play this is to take your chance on a few players a little bit further down and see where it takes you. Mm. I think they've got to be a decent putter or have some other stuff going for him in terms of, you know, we talked about Ategi in terms of his winning history on two quirky events. And we know with Paul Dunne, when his putter's firing, he's absolutely outstanding with the flat sticks. So yeah, that's kind of where I left it. There wasn't really a mid-range player that I felt, you know, compromised in not putting him in. There wasn't a fourth that I was trying to squeeze in and didn't go with in the end. So, quite content with the three that I've gone for, I think.
Lovely. It's an interesting one. I know I always catch a bit of it.
Yeah, I like the event.
Over the weekend or whatever. It's interesting to watch on a Sunday, just, you know, because it's so quirky.
Yeah. No, it's a good one. Good one. Looking forward to it.
Well, thank you for your time, Paul.
Pleasure as always.
Appreciate it as ever. I will speak to you again on Wednesday when we record the Masters podcast, which I'm really looking forward to.
Yeah, me too.
Thank you to the listeners, as ever. It's great that you're supporting us. It's great that your numbers are growing. If you can spare the time, leave us a iTunes review and a actual mark. That'd be fantastic. I will read them out at the start of next week's show. Right, thanks for listening. We will see you again very, very soon. Goodbye.